Today on Wabanaki Windows, we're talking about land, Wabanaki land, that helped build some of Maine's most prestigious colleges. Institutions like Bowdoin College and Colby College were given hundreds of thousands of acres of tribal land, land that was later sold, logged, and used to finance their growth. Much of this land transfer was later determined to be illegal under federal law. We ask, what happened? What does it mean today? And what responsibility remains? My first guest is Reuben Schaefer, a reporter with the Portland Press Herald, who recently brought this story to public attention with his article, For Granted, How Maine's Elite Colleges Sold Wabanaki Land to Bankroll Early Construction. Tribes were stripped of millions of acres. Some of that ended up in the hands of Bowdoin and Colby colleges. His reporting uncovers how large amounts of Wabanaki land were transferred to institutions like Bowdoin and Colby and then used to finance their early development. Reuben, thank you for joining us and for doing the kind of reporting that helps bring these stories into light. Joining us as well is Professor Darren Ranko, at the University of Maine at Orono, and is a Penobscot Nation tribal member and brings critical perspective on how these land transfers fit into the broader pattern of disposition and what that means today. Darren, it's always good to have you with us. We're also joined by Professor Harold Prince, an anthropologist and ethnohistorian whose work has helped document, preserve Wabanaki history and culture for decades. Harold has spent much of his career working closely with Wabanaki communities, helping to tell the deeper story behind the history we often don't see. Harold, thank you for being here and for continuing to help bring that history forward. Let's begin our discussion. So, Reuben, you authored an article. You work for the Maine Trust for Local News, and you did an article for the Maine Sunday Telegram. It came out on Easter Sunday. Really,
That's right.
in-depth article covered the subject really well. And the title of your article is started with For Granted, How Maine's Elite Private Colleges Sold Wabanaki Land to Bankroll Early Construction. Tribes were stripped of millions of acres. Some of that ended up in the hands of Bowdoin and Colby colleges. So, first of all, I want to ask, what brought you to write this article? What started you writing it?
A law student, I believe, or maybe a PhD student, reached out to us. He had published a law review article at the Washington University School of Law, Law Review, and he had gone through and documented a whole series of land grants to private colleges in the East. His intention was to sort of expand on the notion of land grant universities, which we typically talk about as something that exists primarily in the West after 1862, after the Morrill Act. And he reached out to us just hoping to get some attention for this story, and it got bounced around the newsroom a little bit. It landed on my desk. And I just got curious about where this land was. What, you know, he had these figures in here about how much land had been granted to Bowdoin and Colby colleges. And I just got curious about where that land was and how directly it could be tied to Wabanaki possession. And the first thing that I ran across was the 1796 treaty that the state of Massachusetts signed with the Penobscot Nation. And described in that treaty is a bunch of land along the Penobscot River, which, if you look at what was granted to Colby in 1815, is included in that treaty. And so that to me was a very direct, sort of the most direct, the most obvious connection of Wabanaki land to these institutions. And I thought, oh, this could be a pretty interesting story, given just the amount of wealth that these institutions now have today.
So, was there anything that surprised you when you were writing this story?
I mean, I think that the thing that did shock me the most is that that these are both narratives that exist that had yet to sort of really be tied together. And by that I mean that Bowdoin and Colby both openly acknowledge their land grants. They acknowledge that the state was a major benefactor at their founding in terms of providing them with resources, in this case land, that were really critical in the foundation of these institutions. Wabanaki land dispossession is also something that is widely talked about. And the illegality of that 1796 treaty is I think commonly understood. And the immorality of a lot of what was happening at that time is openly discussed. But those two things had yet to be sort of fully linked. The fact that they were intertwined around each other is not something that had been discussed.
The land that was appropriated or given to Bowdoin and to Colby, were those part of the Morrill Act?
No, they were not. This was long before the Morrill Act. Bowdoin's first land grant came. It was granted in Bowdoin's charter, which was in 1794, and they came to select five townships, five of the unappropriated lands is what they were called at the time in 1796, and then they got more in 1806 and 1808, and Colby as well got land in its charter in 1813, and it selected that land in 1815, and then again later in the mid 1800s, but nearly all of that was well before the Morrill Act.
Yeah. So how much land are we talking about here?
In total, about 234,000 acres. The bulk of it was Bowdoin. Bowdoin came to possess something like eight full townships, I believe, in Maine. Something like 182,000 acres. Colby received about 52,000 acres in total.
So how did that help Bowdoin and Colby? How'd that land help?
Well, the land was critical. These colleges they didn't have money at the time. They had benefactors, but they really needed significant resources to get off the ground. If you look back at the histories that have been written of these schools, what you'll find is that they were sort of all as they were trying to get off the ground, they're looking around going, "We need a building. We need a place to house students and teach students. And until we have that, we don't really have a college." It wasn't until Bowdoin was able to sell two of its townships in the right around 1800, 1801, I think, that it was able to then build its very first building, Massachusetts Hall, which was completed, and shortly after it was completed, the college opened. But they're absolutely critical, and the same goes for Colby. Colby's campus has since moved, so those buildings are not, to my knowledge, standing anymore. It was in exactly the same position. Colby was operating out of a rented home. I can't remember who it belonged to, but they were operating out of a rented home until they could build their very first building, which was also funded through the liquidation of some of this land.
Okay, so Harold.
Yeah, thank you, Ruben, for joining us in this discussion. And like many others, I really appreciated your article. It was well researched, well written, and people vastly underestimate the amount of thinking you have to do about things before you actually can make a synopsis of a very complicated story. And particularly because you come in a way from the outside, you have a certain kind of fresh perspective that helps. Talking about a fresh perspective, in 1984, just before I started teaching at Bowdoin, where I taught for 3 years as visiting faculty, I wrote an article. It's called Foul Play on the Kennebec. It came out in an obscure journal that doesn't exist anymore called the Kennebec Proprietor. That was published by the Fort Western Museum. I lived in Halliwell at the time. And I just looked at it, that article, Foul Play on the Kennebec, and it's striking that the story that you tell is actually much deeper that most people don't realize, which was the massive genocidal campaigns against the Wabanaki in the Kennebec Valley and the Androscoggin Valley. And the major role that James Bowdoin, the father of the guy who started with the endowment, the college, and honored his father, James Bowdoin, was one of the Plymouth Colony investors. He was a land speculator, wealthy merchant, and later became the governor of Massachusetts. That included Maine until, as we all know, until 1820. So at that time that we're talking about of the founding of Bowdoin, that was part of Massachusetts, within the jurisdiction of Massachusetts. And Massachusetts has a horrendous history in terms of how its population and its elites have accumulated wealth pretty much from the 1630s when Boston was founded onward. And the massive genocidal campaigns in Maine are really staggering when you begin to look at it. And among the Penobscot, Darren and Donna, of course, are proud members of the Penobscot Nation. But many of those Penobscots have ancestry in the Kennebec and Androscoggin River valleys. A person who is a clear close friend of mine who recently died, Charles Norman Shea, is a lineal descendant of one of the survivors of the Norwich Walk massacre that took place in mid-August 1724. And among the Penobscot, even until actually before World War II, Charles, as a boy, participated in a pageant called the Norwich Walk Massacre that was staged by his aunt, Lucy Nicolar. And Lucy was the daughter of Joseph Nicolar, who wrote the famous book in 1893. He published it, Life and Traditions of the Red Man. And so within the Nicola Shea family, it was a keen awareness of the history of dispossession that did not focus just on the Penobscot River, but also on the Kennebec River. And the major beneficiaries of that dispossession was James Bowdoin and his friends, wealthy merchants, well connected to the political apparatus in Boston, who then financed the foundation of the forts at Fort Western, as well as Fort Halifax. They financed it, but they had the crown pay for the garrison. So it was a very clever way in which they advanced their territorial claims high up in the Kennebec Valley. And then when the Wabanaki protested against the infraction of their tribal lands and killed one of the soldiers, that became a casus belli, that became a cause for war by Massachusetts against the Wabanaki. And then you get in the French and Indian War that we all know that it was basically, as I mentioned several times before, a genocidal campaign because every woman, child, and man either captured or killed, the bounty hunters would get money for it. So I just want to let you know, or our audience know, that's not just these townships that were allocated precisely at the signing of the treaty with the Penobscot in 1796. The 1786 is often mentioned, but it was a failure. It was never ratified by the Penobscot. That was in 1796, and it was exactly at that year, same year, that the allocation of townships that were just taken away from the Penobscot were just allocated to these colleges. So the complicity is quite strong. To the credit of Bowdoin, it started in 5 years ago in 2021. I was contacted by Dr. Kaplan, Susan Kaplan of the Arctic Museum, because Bowdoin College began to look at this history that is related to the foul play in the Kennebec that I just mentioned. But they put two students really at work on it, and that didn't mount much to it. I think there's something going on at the moment. But for some reason, they assigned it to a history professor who I think was already on retirement when you were a student at Bowdoin, correct?
I believe so.
Yeah, so my question to you is how much, as a student at Bowdoin, one of the most elite institutions with the greatest endowments per capita student of any university in the world, really, how much of that awareness of capital, dispossession, genocide, and elite status at Bowdoin were you aware of from any of your professors at Bowdoin?
In my experience as a student, I did not find that we spoke often of the origins of that capital. I think we were certainly aware that it existed. We certainly were aware of the privileges it bestowed upon students at that institution. However, its origins were not something that were widely discussed. It's something that I wrote a little bit about in the story, that Massachusetts Hall as a building is it's a stop on every tour. It's the oldest building on campus. It's this sort of beloved piece of the college history that stands on the main quad there. However, it's the underpinning, the foundation upon that building, the figurative foundation upon which that building stands, and the history there is not something that is widely discussed, at least in my experience as a student at the time. I can't speak for what might be happening within the institution at the moment.
So, Harold, I just have a follow-up question on this 1796 treaty. Can you tell me what that treaty covered?
Yeah, that treaty is really, we're now in the 250th year commemoration of the Declaration of Independence in 1776. The year before the Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia, Chief Joseph Orono, the head chief of the Penobscot Nation, and three young warriors was picked up by a sloop and then sailed to Portland. And from there, because of the British occupation still on the coast and in occupation of Boston, they were given a horse carriage and they were traveling to Watertown. Basically, the revolutionary movement, headquartered at that time in Watertown, because the British were still in occupation of Boston, they needed desperately the Wabanaki on its northeastern frontier not to take up arms against the colonists, because it was a very poorly defended northeastern frontier. So they hoped minimally that the Penobscot and the other Wabanaki nations would remain neutral. Chief Orono was keenly aware of the infringements, ongoing infringements on tribal territories in the Penobscot Valley at the time. And although the agreed upon stop line was the head of the tide, by that time the first white colonists began to cut into tribal lands above the head of the tide, above the first falls, where the seafaring ships could not go. So Bangor has its place, of course, for that reason, and there's very little above river. And so Orono basically asked for protection and a guarantee against further encroachment upriver in the tribal lands in exchange for support of the Wabanaki nations. And that was granted. So after the war, those promises were quickly forgotten. And so he had to fight for at least a semblance of what was promised when the Wabanaki took up arms in support of the Revolutionary War and lost immediately a number of warriors that left widows and orphans behind. And so the promises made were quickly broken. And so that is why in 1784, when the Massachusetts sends out two generals to basically compel the Penobscot into signing a treaty, they basically balked. Then they came back in 1786, and they balked again. So in many history books, it's claimed that the treaty dates from 1786. It didn't, because it was not ratified by the chiefs. Then they basically get a threat to their existence, just like what happened in the Shays Rebellion, a military intervention to wipe out the Penobscot if they didn't comply. Luckily, that didn't happen. But Orono knew the writing was on the wall. So by 1796, when he was a very old man, he and the chiefs, a number of the chiefs, not all the chiefs, agreed to a treaty. And in that treaty, a number of townships were taken. They got a compensation for it. And the other townships were whittled away in the subsequent treaties, the last ones in 1833. So it's a gradual dispossession with, as you quote me in your article, it was a very big quid for a very small quo, or vice versa. I forgot exactly how I put it. But so at the exactly same time, the Massachusetts begins to, and has already started right after the war, because it was in debt to Dutch banks, amongst others. It began to sell off land, and they had a, so the Passamaquoddy weren't even considered at the time for a treaty. That happened only in 1794. It was almost like an afterthought. They were basically, lucky to get anything at all. But by that time, the big land possessions had already taken place with major investors, with London banks, Dutch banks, Amsterdam banks in particular, were all involved. So the massive land capital union that we now talk about, when indigenous peoples are recognized of the original owners of these lands, but that toxic mix of money, labor, and land, because that's really what it takes to build up capital, to make that capital work in terms of interest, and then you get these endowments. And it's not surprising, coming back to Bowdoin College, that the chief financial officer, the person in charge of everything, is by far the highest paid in the state of Maine of anybody, much more than the college president, much more. But that's because he makes capital work, or she now, I think it's a female, a woman, who is the money genius at making the capital get even, for the endowment, even bigger. But look it up, it's all, and ProPublica has published on that. You can see that, the numbers. And that's just probably a fraction, because these people never disclose fully all the perks and the bonuses that come on top of everything else.
Darren, you want to weigh in?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. And thanks, Ruben, for joining us. I love the article, especially the picture. I think the story, you know, of, you know, the Bowdoin family, you know, as sort of is such an important one to think about the transition of Maine as a part of Massachusetts, and then Maine becoming its own state, and sort of the land deal kind of frameworks. Like, as we know from the musical Hamilton, our founding fathers are basically land speculators. I mean, that's like a big part of what they're doing. And whose land are they speculating on? Our land as Indigenous people, right? So I think that the Bowdoin family has the transition point, as Harold has pointed out, both on the Massachusetts side, right, as land speculators when Maine was part of Massachusetts, and then in the early Republic period. And then as Maine becomes its own state, right, there's another push, right, of land speculation and founders for this new state of Maine. And you have, you know, all of what happens with these endowments as they go transition to state of Maine, and you know these treaties, the 1796 we were just talking about, the 1818, you know, sort of sets up Maine, you know, as a place of land speculation in a really specific way going into statehood. That's where the, you know, Harold referenced the treat survey, right, which is kind of a significant, like, we know we have, you know, speculation of all this land. What's going on out there? Like, literally, it's like one of the first things the state of Maine does is send out a survey of all these interior lands that are really still Wabanaki people primarily living in these places, and to the extent that they're inhabited at all. And I think that that's sort of, you know, that, you know, it's not a coincidence they do this survey work, and then, like, you know, 6 years later is the first huge log boom on the Kennebec River, right? So it's like 1826, something like that. So setting up that history of sort of land speculation, extractivism, the building of capital into sort of this new state of Maine. I mean, these are the, like, the important stories of, like, oh, how do I keep track of all this as a project of colonialism, right? So I think, like, that's a really, for me, that's one way to kind of really drive it home as a story, which I think is important. And then just, you know, this, you know, it's so interwoven with, as Harold pointed out, you know, Wabanaki diplomacy, especially Penobscot diplomacies, right? Chief Orono being critical to that, and sort of like, you know, how we're trying to shape these incursions in land speculation, even the fact that one of, you know, there was a Penobscot, was a guide for Treat, right, trying to get Treat to see the stuff from our point of view, much like, you know, our other guides, you know, the guide Thoreau, or guide, you know, like that this is like all a part of this this connection. And I was just talking to James Francis too, like, you know, trying to understand you know, what did Maine look like in 1820 as a Wabanaki place, because it's really, there was not much non-native folks in the interior of Maine. It's still, you know, it took those, extractivist, capital-intensive sort of industries of the lumber and all of those things that really built the interior parts of Maine going up the river valleys. That's the other part of it is like, and we've talked about that waves of like colonialism as part of, land speculation leading to extractive forms of development. And then that's where, the capital intensification, right? You get cheap or, forced labor and, all the stuff that makes America great, like all the things that built the wealth of a nation on. So I like thinking with the Bowdoin family and the creation of the college as a part of that, bringing that, obviously the British colonial structure into then the early Republic and sort of how we think about this land speculation kind of happening in Maine too.
So, Darren, what did this land represent to the Wabanaki people, beyond its economic value?
Yeah, I mean, this is where that idea of whose land is it and then how is it occupied and what is its meaning? These are, especially that 1796 treaty, right, which, starts to erode the idea that we had, a corridor of 6 miles on each side of the Penobscot River. These kinds of things is like these are our homelands. This is the critical the heartland of our culture and our practice of it, our sacred places, right? I mean, you go up all the way into the Katahdin region, you have all of those things. So, we it's so connected to our identities. You look at even the frameworks that, much later someone like Speck came up with, family hunting territories, right? Up and along the Penobscot watershed as like places of, hereditary and clan-based systems of care of those places where we would feed ourselves, where we would tend to, and then come back in community at different times of the year in the place called Old Town, right? And then eventually Indian Island. Because it's also the same time period, right? In the late 18th century, Harold, I think, where the community is sort of forced out of Old Town, the landing in Old Town onto Indian Island, right? I mean, this is a dramatic shift in the day-to-day life of us as Penobscot people to be like, oh, why is our big village right there in the landing in Old Town? It's like the falls, the embankment. This is where all of our major village sites were, right? I mean, look at the major villages on the Kennebec. They're all at falls or at these locations. So, it's a very purposeful attempt to disrupt sustenance, disrupt our culture and the way we're feeding ourselves. And then what happens in the later part of the 19th century, and this is where it becomes particularly, you've used this framework, Donna, the ICE, framework, that idea of isolation, control, those elements of it. It's the full effects of our lands lost for in terms of us being able to feed ourselves comes later in the 19th century, when the state does a whole lot of work to close the commons for everyone, right? Up into the interior of Maine. So, functionally, hunting territories, even, Speck could talk to people in, 1900 and they would know, right, where our territories for hunting and locations of that are. I mean, he's doing a memory exercise, right, Harold, with the people in the community. But by then, by the time he's there, the commons and the regulation of the closing of the commons, meaning can we go hunt and fish in our usual and accustomed places, even though in treaty after treaty after treaty, right, we're demanding these things, including in the 1796 one. The weight of that and then the disabusing of it from our sort of cultural frameworks of care and connection to sacred locations, practice of religion, all of the things that make us who we are.
Harold.
Coming back to James Bowdoin, because Ruben is here as a Bowdoin College graduate, but also a reporter for the Portland Press Herald, and has done a great job taking on a desk on Indigenous issues that, to the credit of progress in time, we have a lot of things to lament, but there's also some progress. If I look at the situation that I found in Maine in the 1980s, when I started working with the Mi'kmaq, the general ignorance in the public was quite staggering, and that's no longer true. The Wabanaki today speak for themselves. At that time, there were very few spokespeople. I was often invited for all kind of lectures and presentations on television, radio, and newspapers. And today, I get no invitations at all because Wabanaki here, except for here on Donna Show, it's a. But that's a paradoxically, my vanishing is an indicator of the progress in time, namely how much has changed. The sheer fact that Darren is, a full professor at the University of Maine and chair of the Native Studies program there, that's extraordinary. That would have been very difficult to imagine 40 years ago. So while there's a lot to be done, a lot has been gained. The fact that the Penobscot have a Penobscot hostess has her own radio show, right? I mean, there's a lot of stuff is happening and has happened, but that consciousness raising needs to continue as your work is about, Ruben, right? It's a you do that as a journalist, and a journalist who becomes fascinated by problems and starts saying, "I'd like to know more about," just like you explained. What motivated to you to do this to do this article? That said, I think that the colleges themselves are underperforming. I'm talking about Bowdoin, Colby, and Bates. They're underperforming because they are cultural and intellectual silos. It's stunning to me, living 15 minutes from Bowdoin College, how little Bowdoin College emanates from into the rest of Maine in terms of where it sheds light where the faculty is to enlighten people in Maine. They do perhaps a great job at some conference in Madrid in Spain, right, or very far away places and talk to colleagues and the whole thing. But I find their beacons of enlightenment not shining well in Maine, and they haven't. They can do a much better job. And so the money that was gained by these colleges in its origins, which was based on dispossession of indigenous lands, the ca staggering amount of capital that has been accumulated in the endowments, it would be very good if they would go beyond the land statement, which is a nice bit of words right outside of the Arctic Museum. It's a wonderful place, great initiative, but these words should be like the Declaration of Independence. They should lead to something. Where is the praxis that follows the theory, and where's the lip service and the action? So, in other words, Bowdoin College, as I mentioned before, stands in my view as an underperforming institution, not financially, they do extremely well, but underperforming as an intellectual institution for the public weal, because it's all geared toward preparing people for very rich careers at Wall Street and wherever they go, and then can be tapped into for adding more to the endowments.
So, Ruben, in your researching this, did you run across some other colleges across the country and any of what they're doing to, improve their education towards the native people? Or did you run across that?
Well, I would I more or less put the same question to Darren when I called him for an interview on this story. So I might kick that one over to him
No, I'm
to
asking
describe.
you.
But well, I can tell you what Darren told me, which was that he pointed to what the University of Maine is doing in terms of the way that it has embarked upon creating a relationship with Wabanaki Nations, particularly the MOU that the university system signed a handful of years ago that dictates sort of more collaborative terms of in terms of how research and the management of particular items is handled and how that's a much more collaborative process. It's not extractive in the way that research often can be. So that was certainly one thing that stood out to me because that was exactly the question: is it are these institutions really doing what they need to do to acknowledge and act upon this history? And if not, what is it that they need to do? So that was more or less where I think my research on for this particular story stopped, at least for now. But it's not to say that I think there are institutions that are doing it right, so it seems.
Okay, Darren.
Ooh, doing it right. Let's talk about that. Yeah. I mean, I think I think the point that I made in the article, it's kind of like what Harold was saying too, I'm consulted sometimes on institutions trying to write land acknowledgments, for example, now. I also have a parody land acknowledgement, which I've probably read numerous times here on this show. But, I think any institution writing a land acknowledgement at this point has to then engage with what Harold is, and this is my recommendation all the time. It's like a land acknowledgement without a praxis or a commitment to a series of, things is worse than meaningless. It's kind of a slap in the face because it rings only as a like this is the past and this is whatever. It doesn't really get into anything significant. I think the kinds of stories out of, there's a couple of sort of frameworks that I would engage. I think my only negative response to Ruben in terms of the article was it was too short. You have so much more to say, right? But I understand the limitations of this.
Always.
But then let's you could think about a series of articles perhaps, and I'd totally support that. I think that since the report from High Country News, the Land Grab Universities report, I mean, I think that through the Morrill Act, right, that has really heightened people's awareness in the academy. They had a lot of, press and energy around that, and even we just had someone to campus for one of the honor societies invited one of the people involved in that work, a native geographer, recently to campus. There's still an ongoing set of narratives, and someone we work very closely with, Margaret Pierce, who was help one of the helpful sort of part of our team that did our campus signage project, and also has done a lot of work with Penobscot Nation on our traditional place names maps. That there's that push, and then the idea of what does it take to understand and explore the history, but then also create a praxis, much like the idea of like a deep investigation in anything doesn't necessarily mean any particular set of actions unless there is a kind of I think it always has to be from ground up and top down, right? It has to be like a movement of faculty students that are interested in this, calling for a framework of action, and then also the leadership being like, yeah, we're committed to this and let's fund it, and like that's it's always how important something is always like the budget. I mean, the moral document of an institution is always like, what are they invested in it? And from our perspective as Wabanaki people, Bowdoin has other populations with studies groups, that they have invested millions of dollars in, and not in any particular way Indigenous or Wabanaki people. So I mean, clearly there's something they can do there. And as well as the other institutions, one report that also has really good recommendations, which I thought goes beyond the High Country News thing, all very much inspired by it. And Donna have had an email exchange about this, is this Truth Project report out of the University of Minnesota that came out in 2023. And Ruben, I don't know if we even got to do that, but
Think
they
so.
had, and they had, it's a 500 pages of the history of the land deals, and UMN is much more directly like the University of Maine, much more directly involved in the Morrill Act elements of this, but they really chase it down in a really deep way, in terms of other sort of things that the university has been involved in also that are pretty nefarious and about extractivism. If you think about Minnesota in the 1860s, right? That the frameworks of colonial structures are different than Maine in the 1860s, right? So I think, but they came out with suggestions like, think about the Board of Regents must think about and review land back or rematriation of indigenous lands. Like have them do that every year. They're talking about reparations in perpetuity because of the beneficiary, element. Like they use very great language around this. And they even connect the fact that because it's the Morrill Act is a federal law, that there's sort of like a trust responsibility, as which I, to me, that was the first time I really see that, try to drive that home of like, knowing what the trust responsibility is in terms of the federal government to federally recognized tribes. I mean, I think, that opened up like even another category. I've been trying to use the history of the land grant process and then the land grant mission in general at UMaine to make the argument for the kinds of transformations that, we talked about just a little bit, Ruben. So, I think a deep exploration into the history, being committed to that, and then making that as a moral obligation. I mean, I think the problems with capitalism per se and the accumulation of capital is just simply how it defines no ethic, right? It defines no moral responsibility towards it. I think that's part of the investment in it. I mean, there's lots of different ways to be engaging in economics, but if the point is like the previous capital accumulation is just part of some past, and then we're not responsible for it in any moral or ethical way in the present, then clearly, what's forcing these institutions into doing anything morally. But I mean, if you're saying like, if you preach social justice, or if you preach, our students are these, special people to change the world, and you can't examine like the literal land you're sitting on, I don't know how hollow that education comes across in any particular way, to those students who are very, very bright and engaged. So, I think we're very in process at the University of Maine. I wouldn't say I think we're a regional leader, but I would say like, there are other places. Minnesota Duluth has some really interesting things. There's a bunch of different places out there that do some really cool things that are pushing the envelope, including Minnesota, the UMN Maine campus, and Twin Cities campus. So yeah, I mean, I guess, even our signage project is just phase one is not even complete, and we have three phases to it. It involves a lot of money to raise, and I'm a busy guy, I can't do all of it, but I think there's just I think the mapping it out in a deliberate way where it's there's the leadership is in the buy-in part of that, and I think that's that can be tricky. I've talked to the leadership at all of those colleges, all three of those fancy colleges in the state, and I just think I always get the sense that I'm asking for too much from them. They feel like, and that I'm asking for a reallocation of resources. They're not ready to have that discussion. And my point is simply like, well, it doesn't have to happen overnight. If there's a long-term plan, you can add a faculty here, a faculty there. I mean, I remember having a discussion with the president of Bowdoin many, many years ago, two presidents ago. And he was just like, we're gonna just hire one. That's the only thing we can do. I was like, please don't hire one native person to be on this campus. Please. Like, it's not a recipe for success on any level. And I just couldn't get them off that position. They hired one person, had to keep replacing them because they kept leaving. And it builds exactly the wrong framework for engagement and the structure of an institution. So I don't know if they can only think about it in those ways. It's like, it's a checkbox, it's a one person for the campus and all the thing. I don't know what to do with that because it's so it lends to such an obvious set of failures for everyone. And then there's almost like, why did we even do that? These people never stay here, like that kind of attitude, which is, where's the responsibility to any of it? So I could rant and rave for a while.
So I think that that Rubin's article sort of educated a lot of people
I agree.
who really, never thought of it, and I'm sure that a lot of Bowdoin people and Bates or whatever didn't really think about it in in depth either. But I think once they know, a lot of them knew, to begin with and just didn't say anything. Anyway, so Harold, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I was thinking about what Darren was just saying in terms of just hiring one person. That's, of course, Herbert Marcuse has a nice term for that. It's called repressive tolerance. And what you then get is, in essence, a system that is part of the regime of inequality, plans and allows certain people to survive in an environment, and then point to them and start saying, "You see how enlightened we are." So that's why, even in a Russian Soviet regime, some dissidents were allowed to speak out, but they could keep control of it because, as long as there were like a few voices, it basically could demonstrate to the world, that Russia was not a tyranny, right? And so the problem with intellectuals sometimes is that if you have one person there, and I should say, by the way, academia has quite a stunning number of pretendians. In other words, people who have somehow claimed indigenous identity and got the benefits of that in their rise in up the academic ladder. And then when native students are in their classes and begin to ask questions about, you say you're a Delaware, for example, or Muncie, and then they go back to their homes in Oklahoma, wherever these students are coming from, and nobody has ever even heard of them. And so the exposure, both in Canada and the United States, of academics and also lawyers and performers who have claimed indigenous identity, they are not necessarily people with any kind of real background in the indigenous communities. And so to back to Darren's point, I personally am not that in favor of identity politics, to tell you the honest truth. I have always treasured academia as a forum for many voices and healthy debate and discourse. But you can only have that when you have people from different backgrounds, whether that's national, ethnic, religious, political, ideological, theoretical backgrounds. And that world is narrowing now in American academia, and not just in American academia, academia across the world. The great opening that happened in the 60s and 70s has been followed up by a great closure, in particular the last 10 years, where academia is no longer, I think, a very healthy place for young people to be educated about the world. But that's aside the point. But back to the indigenous component, yes, it's important that people do not confuse lip service with action. It's a great thing to walk around with a protest signal on your sweater, right? And then go home and drink your latte.
Harold, I feel really called out. I have a hat on that says Wabanaki land back, although I am involved in an organization that's actively getting Wabanaki land back. So hopefully I'm not a poser in that way, but
Ruben, you have anything?
I think this kind of comes back to something that Darren said, and this is one of the highlights of our conversation as a part of reporting the story. But that these land acknowledgments can feel unmoored, they can feel theoretical. One of my goals with this story was to highlight this history, to say that no, this is not theoretical. This is not we're not talking about unceded lands of a tribe that doesn't exist anymore. We're talking about the direct profits of colonialism and the theft of land from a tribe that very much still exists just down the road. We're talking about institutions, from what I hear, that are not built for Wabanaki students. I think Harold talked a little bit to this earlier. I've heard from Wabanaki students who have attended these schools, and I think spoke to a lot of the things that Darren, that you were just talking about, that they did not feel like they were welcomed into them in a way that was meaningful, but that it was a there was certainly some tokenism going on there. I think that might be perhaps the beginning of another story, but there seems to be a dissonance there between the acknowledgement and the action that follows therefrom.
What do you think that the colleges could do? I mean, do you think they could like form some sort of investigative task force or to make recommendations for things to happen? Or, and that's a question not
Well,
just for you, Ruben, but for Darren and as well. So.
was gonna say, I hate to come on here and just parrot what Darren has told me with him in the room, but once again, I think one of the resonant things that stood out to me was this idea that history informs action, and that a deep understanding of your past can inform and inspire meaningful action, and that it needs to start with that deep look.
Yeah, I mean, I think, it can happen different ways at different institutions. I'm big for a single institution cannot be everything to everyone, right? I mean, I think the colleges as liberal arts, I think, all three of them, and obviously the Colby and Bowdoin being much more on the hook in this particular way of getting these state grants of land, which is, our land that the state got through pretty nefarious treaty processes. That idea of what is that institution about? Like, to me, it's always, if you're gonna do this, it has to be mission-driven work. It can't be the extra. You know what I'm saying? It can't be like, oh, Bowdoin stands for, whatever. I mean, I have this ongoing joke that, like, we're being encouraged right now in this moment to focus on, our grants, towards the current federal administration, like the idea that we would, we could retool, especially a place like UMaine, which has so many environmentally focused research projects in the, and offshore wind and all the things. Like, how do we retool for, now we're suddenly doing Department of Defense grants, oil extraction, pieces of white identity crisis. I don't know. Like, how do we retool in this moment? And to me, that would be a huge mistake for the University of Maine to kind of try to retool to guess what's happening at any, for the federal government's purposes. So I would say, like, each of these institutions, though, has very lofty mission-driven statements about the world and their role in the world and what their students are supposed to be about. And I think they just have to define that sense of responsibility as a part of this colonial legacy. So it has to be like not the extra. I think that's the problem with even, it's been so easy for institutions to rename or get rid of the DEI programs on their campuses because they've only honestly ever been just like an extra P. It is like, it's never been, here's the mission of our college or university. It really is about bringing in all these like people who have been denied access to our walls for so long. Like, it's never been that core to many of the mission of these places. So I think that's where the real examination and the, I would say it's precisely like, I mean, this is me, how I think, and Donna recognizes this. It's like, just when everyone else is in crisis, at a play at around the thing like the current federal government, in many ways that's an opportunity to reframe like what we're actually doing here. Like, and I think that that's I would encourage Bowdoin and Colby and Bates to use this moment, which feels like it's counterintuitive, but use this moment to reframe and retool towards something very specific like this, because I think that shows leadership. It shows like, I think these institutions are, as Donna knows, highly risk averse, right? I mean, for and that prevents them from doing things that would otherwise gain them really positive, opportunistic kind of programs, because they're constantly judging or trying to guess like, what is the where are we the most gonna get dinged, as opposed to where are we going to most get this sort of praise of like, who are we and what do we accomplish? So I'd say, again, maybe I'm ranting a little bit, but I think it's mission driven, investing some real resources in that mission and taking it slow, but taking it really methodically. Like, I'm thinking it like University of Minnesota did. They took a couple of years to write a 500-page report, like, but just re they obviously resourced it very well. Like, you just have to like take each step along the way and not feel like this is ever done, but that you're constantly reporting on it, constantly moving it forward. That's how I think of our work at UMaine. Like, we don't, 2018 was a big year. We had the MOU, we had the signage project, we had land acknowledgement. All these different things came in one year, but that was all leading up to like, it didn't happen overnight, right? It took like 8 or 9 years for us to kind of get to those places. So, I just think that that's what I would suggest, and I think it's quite reasonable to resource them well over multiple years.
Well, you know me. I'm getting old. I want to see something done. Get off
Hey,
your
I'm with you.
butts and do something. Like South Dakota University, they did a created a council on truth and healing.
That's right.
And a lot of these councils, there are things that they can do, like suggest policy changes for the university, rulemaking, that sort of thing. More history. Get some, for years we've been trying to get Wabanaki history into the first year as mandatory. So I mean, things like that. I mean, there are other things that could happen too. So anyway, and I'm just thinking that there needs to be a start somewhere. And Darren, you have a Wabanaki center there.
Yes, right. And Donna, you and I have been talking about how to push that into an institution to help guide policies in the state, in various ways. I think a kind of institute. I think I do think building things that are thoughtfully engaged with, I mean, to me, like, I have this immense privilege as a university professor that a lot of my priorities I get set because I value my connections with communities. So the what people in the communities want out of the university. I mean, I'm not saying like I'm successful every time, but like I very much take my cue by that from my engagements with communities. And I think, it's the social distance when I got to UMaine in 2009 was still very great. It's much less now, right? People don't feel as alienated for a bunch of different reasons. But then how does a Bowdoin or a Colby shrink that social distance, making what they're doing there relevant and vice versa? How do they listen to the community? How do they engage with it? I think this doing the work well always will take times to build relationships, to build trust, to build all of the things, right? That we know is just doesn't come quick. It comes from some real deep discussions, some real reckoning. Adada, as we know, like perhaps as Wabanaki people, we show up to the table too many times.
No,
We
not too
aren't
many times. We want to own the table. We want to cook the
own the
meal,
table. But I mean,
I kind of agree, kind of.
oh, I agree with owning the table too, Donna. That's that
Oh,
sounds awesome.
absolutely.
Yeah.
What we've talked about today is not just history, it's truth. The land that helped build institutions like Bowdoin College and Colby College did not come freely. It came from Wabanaki people. And that truth has been largely left out of the story, but now we know. And once you know, you can't unknow. The question is, what do we do with that knowledge? Awareness is the first step, but awareness alone is not enough. The institutions that benefited from this land now carry a responsibility not just to acknowledge this history, but to act on it. Because the truth is not complete until it is matched by accountability. And the question is no longer what happened. The question is what these institutions will do about it. Thank you for joining us, and tune in again next month for another Wabanaki Windows.